Hello friends, I'm your host, Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt Podcast. Betty, how are you, my friend?
I am good. Thank you.
Wonderful. Betty, I'm just going to say this. In 4 years I've been podcasting, I've spoken to people all around the planet. I've spoken to rock stars, everybody. This is the podcast I've been waiting for. And friends at home, if I'm saying that, there's a little clue there that you might want to listen to what Betty's got to say. Because in a nutshell, Betty, I was dying from chronic addiction probably, let's say, 20 odd years ago now. And something happened in my life. It wasn't, groundbreaking. I didn't see a vision or nobody visited me. But I made a decision in a moment of utter pain and sorrow for what I'd become. I made a decision. I was going to stop being the victim. And I was going to do a little bit day by day, get my life back. And I got my life back to a place where I wake up every day in paradise, absolutely every day, guaranteed. And not just that, on the journey, I've achieved every single one of my life goals. I'm blessed with a family that, if you knew me, you'd know I don't deserve them, it's been incredible. So along with saying massive welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt Podcast, friends at home, Betty is a doctor. She's an author. I'm just going to throw this out there. A mystic, expert in shamanism. Let's just say a wonderful, wonderful person. And the first question, Betty, I'm just going to throw it out there in no particular order, is what is enlightenment and should people seek it?
Well, Chris, first of all, let me say, I think it's your story we should be listening to. I mean, anyone who overcomes addiction is able to turn their lives around so totally as you did. That's the miracle. There's not a better story, than what you've just told. I stand in awe of that because I have been close enough to people with addiction to know that that's a miracle. That's huge, what you've done. And that you love every day of your life. That's what we should do, is love every day and be grateful for the day.
Can I say also, though, Betty, and this is for our friends out there that might be struggling, I've relapsed hundreds of times.
Well, I think that's part of the program.
Yeah. But the thing is, even when I relapse and even when I'm, I'm never going to go back as low as I did. That's just the way recovery works. I just can't, I did learn some. But even when I'm like in a dark place and I still love myself, I still love this universe, I still know that I am universe. And I don't feel sorry for myself. I just say, right, come on. Come on, Thrally. You got to get on the horse again. So yes.
But that's what's so important, because I think on the planet, people don't feel that way about themselves or about the world. I think that we have been told for so long we're nothing. The Western worldview is that there's nothing but matter. That's all you are. You're a fluke of nature. There's no meaning, no purpose. And when you're dead, you're dead. Well, I think we've destroyed our children. We've destroyed so much of that possibility of knowing who we are, that we are these beautiful, immortal, creative, divine beings. But everything in our culture, practically everything, but almost, has tried to tell us otherwise. So when we can discover who we are, that is already creating the path before us. I always like to refer back to the story of the Deuteronomist. Margaret Barker, a great Old Testament scholar, realized when all of the texts were available, not just the canons, the approved text, she realized that the first temple, Judaism, was a shaman mystic tradition, and that that was destroyed in 621 BCE by the Deuteronomy. We don't really know much about who they were, but they were priests. They came in, they destroyed everything. And this was an incredible tradition of mystical knowing who we are. And the Deuteronomists destroyed that tradition. They destroyed the Holy of Holies, where the feminine divine was married to Yahweh. Yahweh was married. He had a co-creator. They co-created the world together. And in the Holy of Holies, she, the feminine, gave birth, of course, to the sacred child, which we all are and can be. And she had, the tree was her sacred symbol. And so she had groves of trees. The Deuteronomy them down, destroyed them, destroyed every image of her. And they even got rid of the sacred texts, which were mystical texts. And they retold, inverted many of our myths, our sacred story, because our sacred stories are not made up by the left brain. They really, as Carl Jung liked saying, there's an organizing principle within us that creates these stories to reveal to us who we are. So long before the Deuteronomists came along, the tree, both in Sumeria and in Egypt, and both traditions had influenced the Jewish tradition, that the tree was sacred. It was the feminine, which is symbolic of the right brain, the heart that opens us to the universe, that love is the key. And so she was the tree, rooted deeply in the earth and reaching up to the sky. And in Egypt, what is wonderful, those trees, the very trunk of the tree is feminine, and she is offering them the fruit. Sometimes it's in a glass, sometimes it's fruit. And in 2500, Sumerian seals, in fact, I have that seal in the book, the goddess is sitting on one side of the tree, the god on the other, and there's fruit, heavy fruit hanging from the tree, and they are both, here it is for you. Well, what did the Deuteronomy? They have God, who's now does not have any connection with the feminine, with soul, with right brain. He's a left brainer. And he says, you may not eat of the fruit. That's absolutely forbidden. You cannot eat of it. And of course, once you tell people, as parents, we know, once you say, don't do that, that's exactly what's probably going to be done. And so Adam and Eve eat of it. They have sinned. They become sinners. And actually, forever, even their children, their offspring are sinners. And they are cursed. Nature is cursed. The woman is cursed in childbirth, the most sacred. That's cursed in the sense that she will have to suffer. And poor Adam is going to have to scratch the earth forever and be miserable to try to get food. This is a horrible thing for a God to do. And then, to top it off, God tells them they're not worthy of living on this planet, that is, in the Garden of Eden, and he throws them out and has an angel there with the sword. So what kind of story is this? This is not a true myth. And I can remember even as a kid thinking, but if it's God, why would he not want us to know things? The fact that for over 2,000 years that we've actually even considered this story as having any worth whatsoever is just amazing to me. But we're still, the Deuteronomists of today are still telling us we need to be fixed. We need to be transhumanized. We're not really worthy of living on the planet. You know, this Deuteronomists are still with us, in other words. So I think we've had to overcome this. Of course, then with that censorship, starting with the Deuteronomists, the Roman Church took that over and continued us needing to be fixed or saved and not worthy. And then the church, actually, many people don't know this, that it was the censorship of the church that prevented scientists in 1660, when the Royal Society for the Advancement of Science was formed, they were forbidden to study anything but math because the church didn't want any heretics around, that is, mystics, to go against their doctrine. So there we are. We've been a people constantly told, well, we're really not worthy. Well, when the Nag Hammadi texts were found in 1945, these were texts which were used in the ancient world and early Christianity. There were many, many texts, but the church destroyed or promised to destroy any text that went against its doctrine. And the Nag Hammadi texts make it very clear that Jesus had a very different message. It is not enough to follow the Christ, but to become the Christ. You are to become who you are, the Christ. Christ That's the message we need to hear. And your message is the same.
Yes. My message is love, because we're, the way I see it, Betty, we're the universe experiencing itself subjectively. So you exactly. and me, you are me and I am you. That's why I've never met you, but I love you unconditionally, despite the mistakes you might make or the actions you do that personally I wouldn't. And obviously, because to hate on myself would really be weird. And it wouldn't, I don't see in any way how that can achieve anything. But of course, this is the 3D realm, isn't it? This is the physical, the birth certificate identity. Can I just say, the number on my wrist is I'm in a triathlon in the morning. So they put the number on your hand with, it's supposed to be indelible ink, but it's water, it's come off when I wash my hands already. So folks, I'm not being chatty. This is sport. But of course, a lot of people, Betty, they've grown up with their birth certificate. They believe that education has indoctrinated them. You're this physical Newtonian physics body made up of molecules, and you should go out and you should try to achieve. But of course, you're not going to achieve very much. But this guy, he's like going to be way better than you. And it's a powerful indoctrination into just one realm of life, isn't it?
It's such a, I after our son died and we had the experiences we had, I wrote in The Miracle of Death that I realized I'd been living in one square inch of the universe and calling it reality. And I think that's what so many of us do. You know, we have, you've described it all enough. That's exactly what happened.
Yes. Do you want to, could you talk a bit about your son's death, Betty, if you're okay to? I mean, what kind of, you know, what did that stir up in you?
Well, you know, I had all my life, I had been looking, trying to figure it all out, as it seemed so crazy, some of the things from the Bible. And yet I was, my brother and I went to church because we always found, we moved a lot. So we always found a good group of kids and we went there. And my parents didn't, which I think gave us a lot of freedom. But I remember hearing stories about Jesus and wonderful stories. Here was a man who was so optimistic and caring and healing. It was a wonderful model for development. But I couldn't believe in Christianity. I finally came to realize I had to put it in these terms. I wanted to know. I wanted to experience. Well, so all of my life I was looking for the experience. And in the meantime, I was studying everything I could. Well, and I had gone to South America to work with before our son's death. I'd done so many things trying to break through, you know, but I think that I had gone to the university simply because I didn't know how else to try to figure things out. And of course, there was the indoctrination, you know, that fiction of superiority of rational thinking, which I didn't accept, but some place in me had been addicted to it, brainwashed to it. So when and my son was kind of interested in that sort of thing too. My husband was, he was athletic. He was a risk taker. You know, he was somewhat like you in the sense of just wanting to live life fully. And he was very optimistic. But he was, you know, he was sympathetic. He was tolerant of my endeavors and respected me. But when our son died, everything changed. He was in a car accident and was in the hospital for about 2 weeks. But a week before that happened, my husband was in his office here, and he suddenly had a vision of Pishti is our son's name, Pishti's car on the side of the freeway, and his body was superimposed on it. So he knew he was dead because it was two different dimensions. It was superimposed. And he heard himself say, "Oh, that's right, Pishti. It's almost time for you to do that." And that shocked him. You know, what am I talking about? And Pishti answered him in the vision and said, "That's right, Dad. I'll be out of the house for a little while." Well, Ishvan, my husband, didn't know what that meant. But as soon as that happened, he was totally unconscious of it. He didn't remember that vision until we got the call from the hospital that he'd been in an accident, although he didn't tell me until Pishti died. So it was, I had 2 years of dreaming that my son died, But I looked at it symbolically. And when Pichu was little, we always talked about his dreams and if he had an important one he wanted. And at 12 years old, I was in the afternoon when he remembered it. I was vacuuming the floor and he said, "Oh, Mom, I just remembered a dream." So we sat down. I wrote it down. And he said, "I was in a hospital in a trauma center, and I had just been in the operation room. I was up above the hospital looking down at my dead body. And then there was a period of dark space. And then I was on the other side, and there was like a big horseshoe. I was at the top of the horseshoe, four boys on the right, four on the left. And then we saw an eternal fire in the center. And across from me, I saw the aura of a 10th boy. We were all waiting for him to arrive because we knew that when he arrived, I would be complete because 10 is an completeness. What do you think it means, Mom?" I thought, "Oh my." We talked about it. And I said, "Well, you know, you are dying to the child because you're going into puberty." And we talked about those things, which it didn't really that concerned me. The dream concerned me. But I gradually was able to look at it symbolically as I did those dreams that I had for 2 years. But when he actually died, well, of course, it's quite a trauma. But the day after his memorial, both Istvan and I felt his, and then we began to have visions with him. Now, my husband, of course, he had never had anything like that. And his first vision with Pishti lasted quite a while. And when it was over, he sat up on the, "I had no idea. I will never look at the earth." And he didn't. That was it for him. people who have these experiences will often say it was realer than real, And I think that you just know that it is true. You don't question it. It's just so powerful. And so we continued to experience his presence. We took every weekend for meditation. And we also, since I'd been in South America, we worked some with sacred medicine, as our ancestors did for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And in whether they were spontaneous visions or we worked with sacred medicine, and he wanted us to know that he was fine. He was alive and still creating. And he wanted us to know that for our sakes. But he also wanted us to know that the earth is going through a very difficult and powerful traumation, and to kind of know what was. So we were, we had no question that about the fact that he was, that made all of the difference. And I think that is our heritage as human beings. We are to be connected to the other side, not separated from it, as this craziness of censorship has done to us. We have censored from 621 BCE, the church continued it. For all of those years, we have censored who we are so that we have not lived the kind of full life that you talk about. It's meager, and we listen to authority, and we're brainwashed into believing so.
Yeah, well, hopefully not us, but people live in fear, don't they? And very powerful. So just going back to my original question. So for me, Betty, enlightenment is I've learned to transcend this material existence and this identity. And by tweaks in my lifestyle, like I'm very keen on being, we say pH neutral, I eat lots of green vegetables, green being chlorophyll being the sun being, a hugely important thing. And when I do that, when I lay off alcohol or whatever the substance might be, which is my, mission for life, I because I'm on good terms with all people, because I love everything and everyone, I have this just beautiful connection with life. And I actually feel like I'm in the quantum. And I've talked this through with my life coaching students, and they tell me, "Chris, why don't I feel it? What you're feeling?" I say, because, your terminology, your use of language, you're still so anchored in the past. And I understand the past doesn't exist. I have this moment right now. The past is, depression. Future is anxiety. And I don't label myself. Yes, people think I'm an ex-Marine or whatever, and I might play on that purely for my professional career, because the people I'm talking to are in that world of identity politics. So, but really, I'm I don't think of myself as existing. I think of myself as the universe. So when I see my clients, they're going, Chris, you know, I was never in the forces and, you know, I just regret. I'm like, whoa, for a start, that's in part, the past doesn't exist. So why are you even think, why are you anchoring? Secondly, you've got unresolved healing there to do. Thirdly, you don't know what it was like in the forces. It wasn't that good. Fourthly, you might have been asked to do and commit a horrific act that could have catastrophic consequences for your mental health, you know? And so could we put that to bed now? I didn't think of it like that, Chris. Yeah, I'm sort of lucky, aren't you? Yes, you're lucky and you need to be you or this cluster of molecules that they call you. And what I'm trying to do, buddy, is move them forward so that they make the connection that I've made. And when I'm there, when I'm in that zone, I've just, you know, all this set of molecules, it's very, very powerful. So to me, that's enlightenment. It's transcending this existence to make a connection with the divine, of which I consider myself like an equal part. Is that how you feel about enlightenment, or am I just...
Yes. No, you asked me and you answered the question. I absolutely think that, because our ancestors did everything they could to preserve the knowledge, the wisdom that we are all divine and that we are so creative and that we're, and that, you know, as has been said, we're all born out of universal wisdom, universal consciousness, cosmic. That's who we are. But we have this vow that kind of limits that vast consciousness so that it can just trickle down and we can do our grocery shopping and do daily things. Every civilization has the responsibility of knowing how to release that vow so that we can live in what you're describing, in cosmic, be there. And instead, what most civilizations have tried to do is to censor that knowledge, tighten that valve so that we get not even hardly a trickle, and that everything is left brain. And as Ian McGilchrist in his book, The Master and His Emissary, has made so clear, the whole worldview that we've had is only what the left brain can experience. Mm-hmm. It can't experience enlightenment. It can't experience the context of all of its parts it's analyzed.
That's how I got there, wasn't it? Was becoming more empathic. I remember when I always was sort of all right, Betty. You know, I wasn't a terribly bad person. I've done some bloody stupid things in my life, but but I do remember that moment where, yeah, I could just sense other people's pain. And on that thought, one thing I've loved reading is the Gospel of Thomas. And I saw a Harvard professor doing a lecture on it, and he was reading through, and he would say, and he's talking to his students, he's like, you know, this gospel, it turned up, you know, in ancient Egypt, da 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 da, and they believe that Thomas could be Jesus or Yeshua's brother because it's Thomas Didymus, which means, you know, like pair. And he read this passage. He said, a woman walks home from the shop, and this is, friends at home, this is the actual words of Yeshua or Jesus. I hope Betty can clarify which one we're supposed to be saying here. His actual words rather than like what people have written after the fact sort of thing. And he's said to have said, you know, a woman walks home from the shop, not realizing she's got a hole in the shopping bag. When she gets home, the bag is empty. And this guy was like flabbergasted as to what nonsense this Jesus is talking. And I'm like, it's obvious, it's saying if you don't make that connection to spirit, you go your whole life, you get to the end and you didn't even know what you were here for, in, you know, which is to experience life subjectively on behalf of the divine. I'm that's my sort of guess. Was that one of the Nag Hammadi texts?
Yes, it was found in the Nag Hammadi text. And of course, I mean, that's incredible, because exactly what you say, I mean, that's what most of us are doing, carrying around that bag. We've been given everything, in a sense, and we can go through life just letting it just fall out, not even knowing it's there, getting home and it's empty, and feeling so miserable. I think that that's the very worldview we've given people. There's nothing. There's nothing in that bag anyway. You know, there's a beautiful story from the Sand Bushman that I absolutely love, is that that there's a man who has beautiful, and he's so happy because they give beautiful milk every day. And then he began to realize the milk was less. So he stayed up to see what was, and he saw these women coming from, and they were coming down. And so he ran out there and chased them away and was yelling at them. And the most beautiful one he called, and he married her. And they had many years together, very happily. But she, in the beginning, she gave him a little box, and she said, whatever you do, don't. And so for years, he didn't. Then one day, of course, she was out. He just thought, how silly, why don't I open this? This is a little box. So he opened the box, looked at it. And when she came home, she immediately knew he was cheating. And she said, you look. And he said, oh, yes, I did, you silly, silly girl. Absolutely nothing in that box. Why should you have kept it all these years and told me not to? You silly, silly girl. And she just held her heart and she said, and he said, of course, there's nothing there. And the story ends with her going and disappearing, and she was never seen on the earth again. And I think that that story applies for the San to their sacred traditions and their mysticism. They didn't tell us those stories because we would simply have who saw and broke their hearts. So I think the same as, you know, in a way, it's there's not, we've been telling there's nothing there for centuries, and we're nothing. When it's the opposite, but we didn't have the eyes to see or the ears to hear. As in those texts, Jesus always says, this is for those who have ears to hear or eyes to see.
Yes, I love that gospel. I don't want to repeat anymore because I've got such a bad memory that I'll get them wrong. But, if you look for, when he's talking about, is it the Father? And he says, if you look in the birds, you'll see them in the birds, and if you look in the sea, da, 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 da. Yeah. It's just
everywhere.
It's just, it's beautiful. But what he's getting at is the last place people think to look is inside, isn't it?
You know? Yeah,
it's inside. So gnosis, Betty. I love this because when people say to me, Chris, like, how can you be so sure that you know? And I say, it's just your opinion. And I say, no, it's not my opinion. I know. And of course, we relate that to people being big-headed that think they know everything. But it's not, is it? I say, know yourself and you'll know the universe. Or you can do it the other way. You can know the universe and then you'll know yourself. Let's just take the Yeshua and the, so my understanding is, Jesus Christ. Christ comes from the word the anointed one from ancient Greece, which is to do with the sacred secretion or the kundalini. Whereas Yeshua was probably the flesh and blood, the actual Jesus. Is that how you see it, Betty?
Yes.
And a lot of people, because they're in the 3D realm, they just stop at the Jesus thing, don't they? And they don't kind of, you know, they're not understanding that this is allegory. This is talking about a alchemical process.
Absolutely.
Within the body.
And the church, when, you know, Margaret Barker makes it pretty clear, convincingly clear, that Jesus was a rebirth of that ancient shaman mystic tradition of the first temple, Judaism, as is Kabbalah. Probably Kabbalah is saving of that experience through all of the traumas that the Jews went through and keeping these texts. These sacred texts were taken to Egypt by Jews at that time. Deuteronomists got rid of them out of the sacred text. But Jesus was, he was the mystic and the alchemist, yes. And the church, once again, inverted that sacred experience, sacred story that very clearly Jesus is trying to make clear in the text that they were going to destroy, but the monks buried and we found them, in which Jesus makes it very clear that when you drink from you, and like there's no difference, is that if we hear what he's telling, he said, I did not come to save you. I came to remind you of who you are. And he said, it's not enough to follow, but for you to realize you're the Christ, your own Christianity, by going within. And the heart, of course, to all our ancestors in the shaman mystic tradition, the heart is central. We now know, of course, that the heart is the fifth brain component, you know, and they knew that intuitively, that the heart connects to the right brain, the symbolic, poetic logic, and it connects us to the universe as well. So, yeah, I think that Gnosis was, or the Gnostics, Gnosis, there were many different kinds of Gnostics, but Gnosis itself is a way of knowing. You know it through the heart, through cosmic consciousness, through the consciousness, that universal consciousness or cosmic consciousness. We are that. We are that. And a cosmologist, Jude Curvin, has said beautifully, which I think is absolutely the truth, that we are all the manifestations of the Big Bang or the Great Whisper, whatever you want to call that beginning. We are all manifestations of that. We are that. And we are co-creators with that. I think that science is beginning to an understanding a little bit worthy of the universe is a remarkable thing. But isn't that beautiful? We are the manifestations of the divine creation, and we are co-creators. In the book, Merchants of Light, I try to talk about how long biologically nature worked to create, or let's say we worked very hard, to bring about a consciousness that could co-create. And we have, and yet most of us see nothing in the box.
Yeah, I was in a podcast the other day, and I wasn't sort of thinking too much. And I said, if you believe modern science or historian, I think a lot of people that get pushed, being an author myself, I know my books are never going to get pushed. But I think if you toe this sort of mainstream line, your book, these authors' books seem to get pushed out there. And I refer to kind of like Sapiens, that has the notion that we came out the African bowl just 80,000 years ago. And I just say to people, come on, think about it. You know,
80,000.
You know, 2,000 years ago, if we had, let's say, the time of Jesus, the guys then looked just like us. So it's not a stretch to think 10,000 years ago, pretty much look like this. 10,000 years ago, just eight times that, 80,000, what, we suddenly were, you know, this had these negroid, if that's the right word, features, and we probably didn't have the ability, your basic language. I say we must have been here millions of, and our actual history, I described it in this podcast as trillions of trillions, but what it meant is infinite, isn't it? You know, it's infinite. We're not just a product of being Homo sapiens. Before that, you know, we evolved into that at one point. We were possibly, and I'm folks, you know, I can only go with what I feel, but maybe we were this single cell organism at one point. But what I was going to say is, I often joke like this. One day, you know, God was up there in the void, there's nothing, he's playing, he couldn't play his Xbox because he hadn't invented it yet. And he thought of this clever game, right? You know, I'm going to start creation. And I want to know if through this random process, this incredibly random process that will go on and on and on through millions, if not billions upon billions of years, whether there ever be an organism develops that has intelligence, and whether it will ever develop the intelligence to realize it is me and we are all one. Therefore, we seek peace on, you know, peace on earth, rather than this division and constant state of conflict and war. I don't know if these dark entities, whether they understand all this, Betty, but they create the wars just to keep everybody in the darkness. But am I sort of making sense?
Well, you know, there's so many ways of looking at it, because scientists tell us that we have been who we are today 200,000 years, that we had the same anatomy, brain, so on. And what's interesting is, but we are life. We are part of all of the life forms in the universe. And I think there is a basic intelligence out of which everything is created. And our ancestors wanted more than anything to understand that intelligence. They said, with nature, we wanted to understand the laws of nature, of the cosmos. So even during the megalithic age, when these massive structures were built all around the world, which were both temples and observatories, that they saw the human being as the mediator between this intelligence of the earth, the laws that operate here, and the laws of the, we could be the mediator between these. These are that the universe is out of intelligence, and different creatures play different games of how to experience realizing who we are. You know, it's that, as I remember Alan Watts and the city used to say that we are that, you know, when we realize that. And that I just think there's so many ways of looking at it that can be beneficial and fruitful. But I think if we go back to gnosis, is that we have the ability, we have everything in us to know everything we need to. And that was the teaching of Jesus and all great mystics, is that you go within and you find the universe. And I think, as you said, maybe you find the universe, you begin to realize that's within me. And we've been taken so far away from those truths, the laws of nature of the human psyche, that we're just splattered all over the place. You know, postmodernism, in which everything is fragmented, there's no metamyth, there's no one value. It's all, we can say it this way, tell the story this way. We've been censored since 621 BCE, and then the church did a number, then governments did the number. And we've been, you know, we had the Habsburgs, which destroyed us if we thought otherwise. They destroyed all these shaman mystic cultures. Mysticism was heresy. Feeling, there was no, the feeling in after science, we don't care what you feel, that's unimportant. But it's a way of knowing. It's intelligence. It's wisdom. So we're really today suffering from all of the censorship. And these people who want to control the world, keep us in war all the time, look at the whole planet as a game and a way of control and power, are, I like to look at them as extremely ill. They have been, the whole universe has been censored out of them. No enlightenment there. So that they play these games, and it's a left brain game severed from the right and the heart and the universe. And it sees only what the left brain, and it can manipulate, it can do all kinds of crazy. Postmodernism is a left brain schizophrenia. And that's when we think, well, that doesn't make sense. Why would these people want that? They'll suffer too. Well, we're looking for a logic that they don't have. The poetic, sensible logic is not there. So I think that gnosis is when we go within and we feel, we experience. There's no question. We know. And that's what gnosis actually is, to know. But the church actually taught people not to do that. I had two students who became Christians, one a Catholic, one a Protestant. And the church taught them, they were having some very powerful experiences, but the church told them, no, that's of the devil. You have to ignore that. That's of the devil. You cannot go within for truth. It's exactly the opposite of what Jesus, but the church did that, and it's still active in some church. It's horrifying to me to think that, again, we're robbed of who we are. And Jesus said, I came to remind you of who you are.
I heard recently, Betty, I love Alan Watts. He's great to listen to when I have a sauna in the morning. But I heard he died of alcoholism. And I just found that a real, he was just so, he had so much wisdom.
That who?
Alan Watts.
Oh, Alan. Yes, I did. Yes. I have heard that too. And
I just kind of thought, Alan, you were like talking the talk so well, but why didn't you go within? But I'm also well aware of just the hideous nature of addiction. It's easy to say things. To use a biblical expression, it is the devil's come knocking at the door again.
I always, because Alan Watts was, when I was in my 20s, I loved to listen to him. That was in the 60s. He came to America. He was talking a lot. And I've always been grateful to him. I've said, I heard that and I didn't understand it either, because he knew what he was talking about, but what had happened. But he certainly was inspiring for me, at that time. And I'm so grateful to him for his work. And I don't know what that experience ultimately brought him, but I'm grateful to what he taught me, you know, and others.
Oh, massively. It's so enlightening. It's incredible. Betty, I didn't think we got, when I asked you, could you just explain for our friends out there why people refer to Jesus as Yeshua or Yeshua, or which is, I guess, an old form of Joshua?
You know, I don't know how to answer your question. I think that I always just saw that as his name, a translation. We call it Jesus, Yeshua. I don't know more than that.
Okay. I listened to some quite in-depth stuff. A friend of mine's got a great podcast, a chap called John St. Julian, and he's goes really deep into this sort of stuff. So I apologize. Oh. It's kind of like my head's in there.
He would know more than I. Yeah. He would know then, not I.
Yeah. Yeah. And so can we talk then about the quantum layer? Is that, you know, I watched a great, I love watching these ancient Egypt documentaries. Not the ones on the TV, because they tend to be sort of, you know, stick with a narrative. And that I love the stuff you can find on YouTube. And the other day, a chap was explaining some of the, not the hieroglyphics, like what do they call the pictures? The friezes, we'd say, you know, these ancient
paintings.
Yeah. And there's one of there's, you know, many of people with a net, and the narrator did a brilliant job of describing how the net represents the fabric of the universe on which from which everything comes out of. So I think of that as this eternal energy field, hence why people refer to it as the quantum level. And I just wondered if you had any insight into what you've learned the nature of the universe is. You know, you hear words like simulation theory and over to you, Betty.
Well, it's interesting that the quantum field, as described by physicists, is very similar to the description that mystics give of the spirit. And in fact, I have in my books the similarities, is that it's eternal. It records everything that has ever happened. And it knows everything, has all of the knowledge, its infinite ability to record, and its love, what we call archetypes are the experiences that we draw from the quantum field, and they take the symbolic form as first, and then we bring it into time and space. But I think that it is that universal consciousness that we were talking, that we are all born out of. It is the all, everything. It's infinite, no beginning, no end, total creativity. And the net, I had several experiences with the net of light around the earth and within the whole universe. Interestingly, our ancestors knew of this net. It looks like a net of light. In one vision, I saw that the net of light around the earth had been damaged, but that we were all working to get this net back together and then ignite it. But we ignited it through our own inner experience. That's how we heal the net. But yes, it's Indra's net that contains everything, the all. It is a description. So I think that earlier, before we had physicists, we knew that it was spirit. It's eternal, all-knowing, loving, no beginning, no end, total creative, total potential, and that the net was also symbolic.
Betty, one final thing for you. It's been an absolutely beautiful and pleasurable conversation. Thank you. We're in interesting times from a sociological perspective. One of my friends I used to chat through, because we both did a bit of sociology at when we were studying to go to university. And he said, Chris, you know, do you think things are worse now than they were, say, in the 60s, or they were in the 1800s? And what he was kind of getting at was, you know, there's always going to be this yin and yang. There's always going to be good and evil. There's always, you know, certain amount of crime, that in the 1800s, you know, they were probably worried about the plague was the great evil. In my lifetime, it was the poll tax, this tax the government just chucked on everyone, and this kind of stuff. And when I look at life now, I think yes, I think out of Babylon have come bloodlines that are just very manipulative. Mm. But what are your thoughts of changing changing this darkness that we see in society?
Well, you've been suggesting it with everything you've said, and that is how do we bring about change? It's the old story. We have to be that change. And that's what you're saying about the frequencies and about going within and maintaining that to try to keep our balance in that very, very powerful energy field of light. I think that there's really nothing we can do other than create. We're creating all the time. I had a very powerful experience in which, in part of the vision, I found myself in the forest, and I said, but I can't create a world. And because I was realizing we are it. And then I said, but, and coming with the old story that we've been taught for centuries, I can't create a world. And the voice said something to me that was so powerful. You can do nothing but. We are creating with every breath we. And so I think that when we hear all of these things about the WEF and the UN and the Great Reset and the darkness and the currents, we hear those things. It's natural to think, oh, this would be the most horrible thing in the world. And if they actually change the human species, we won't even have our species in. You know, we can go to a place, and I've gone there when I've started doing all of this research about that darkness. And you can, you know, you have to find your way back. And the way back is by going within and remembering the power of the light, the power of the divine that is constant, that lightly coming into our, you know, when I wrote the book, Merchants of Light, it's because my husband and I had both had experience with what they call themselves, the Merchants of Light, the Invisible College. These are energy forms that have been on the earth many times, but they come at a time when we especially need it. And it's us, perhaps, it's our own energy that we have available, our own powerful frequency. And I think at least what we discovered in those experiences is that we have drawn this energy field to the earth, and it is now anchoring itself in the earth. The vision was that this light has been around the planet for eons. And now, because we are waking up and calling that light to us, and we're anchoring it in the world, we're becoming like lighthouses. And one person isn't it. It's all of us together. And I think that it's remembering, as Arthur Miller used to say, remember to remember. If we can remember, we are, and there's nothing more powerful. And so I had to heal myself remembering to remember.
Beautiful, Betty. One last thing I must ask you. I would kick myself if I'd forgotten, and I nearly forgot. That's kind of the story of my life. Synchronicity. And the last thing I'll add, Betty, is had we had this conversation probably 6 years ago, I would have laughed at myself. I always think that's some kind of hippie nonsense. What are you going to do? You know, roll a doobie and go and hug a tree and you know, dance naked around some stones. It really would have been insane to me. Now it, you know, it's become my life. And just seeing, you know, I stop a podcast and it's one hour and 33 minutes. I upload a podcast, or my wonderful editor Luke uploads a podcast, and I see I go to check on it, it's got 33 likes. And
well,
what do we think of synchronicity?
Well, of course, it happens. And I think the more we're sort of in the zone, the more we recognize it. You know, around Pishti's death, it just seemed like there were so many synchronicities again and again and again from our dreams, from the visions, from his actual experience of death. It just happened. It happens all the time. But I want to go back to the numbers of 666 and gematria and that old number system that they call it the number of the beast. Well, it's the left brain or the masculine that has not united with the feminine, which is the 3 and 6 and 9. That is the feminine, which is symbolic of the right brain and the heart connection. So when the 666 comes together with the 9, I don't remember what that adds up to, but it adds up to the total, which is wholeness, the individual human species of wholeness. So they had it all figured out too, is that these have to come together. And it's so interesting because when you think of Egypt, I mean, Egypt was, I think they came so close to, they knew what they needed to know to create a civilization, because we're told that they had actually achieved kind of the theory of everything, that the sacred science, which they never talked about in terms of theoretical principles or the actual principles of science, they simply manifested it in their art, in their temples, and in everything that they did. And the temples, it looks as though each temple, if you walked into that temple, it was structured in such a way, the sacred geometry, the alignment, the water, the stone, everything was structured in such a way that you would know the principles, these sacred scientific principles, not literally, but you would experience totally. You would have that immediate visionary experience of the truth of that those scientific principles. And each temple was different, so that if you went through every temple and experience their reality, then you would have that cosmic consciousness. And it's kind of interesting because they never separated the left brain from the right. And that allows intuition to really blossom. But also there was a Jeremy Nadler, who wrote about the shamanic text in the pyramid, talked about a priest who was trying to explain to the Greeks who did separate the left from the right. And he said, what we do is this, is that we are always within the realm of the sacred. What we, as we feel, as we meditate, as we think, we read, we are always within that realm, which means they're always connected to the heart. And we do not study anything outside that sacred. All of this is within that sacred. And I think that that's how we build a civilization, is that we learn our problems will not be solved by the left brain, by conceptual concept. It has to be solved by the way you were taught, that you go within and then we can find civilizations or people, you know, who have understood this and ignite it in us and the world, so that we can build a civilization in which we trigger that valve whenever we have the time. We walk into a release and we know of the universe. So I think we're learning how to do this again after being censored for so long. You are talking about it and it's beautiful and living it and igniting others. And of course, you know the secret, the key to it all. In one of the first Renaissance periods of the rebirth of the shaman mystic tradition was in the High Middle Ages. And there was a powerful understanding of love, that love was the highest vibration that we could experience, and that when we experience that, and we are merging our heart with the heart of the world, and that's how we change and transform the world.
And one thing to finish on is they say there's one element above love, and that's authenticity. And I think in this world of social media, that is something that people are really, Chris, how can you be so honest and tell your story? Why would I not? There's nothing about my story that's just not utterly, I mean, you know. Someone said to me today, you were just a drug addict in Hong Kong. And I it's a funny thing replying to comments from people you haven't met. Do you comment and feed their narcissism? And I said to my girlfriend, I said, can I just write back, yeah, that was like the best experience I've ever had in my life, you know, when I nearly died, living homeless on the street, working for a Hong Kong triad criminal gang. That's when I wasn't long after that when I learned to love myself. And it wasn't long, and when I learned to love myself, I learned to be grateful for what I've got.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I learned that I didn't need to be altering my mind with substances. I didn't need to be trying to prove myself working as a nightclub doorman. I didn't need that. I'm beautiful as I was, Betty, you know. And it's like your worst experiences that ironically the things you learn the most from, isn't it?
Well, I think it's absolutely the truth, is that if we didn't fail again and again, or go through terrible experiences, or feel ourselves to be totally inadequate and nobody, you know, is that we wouldn't grow. We wouldn't be able to be grateful. And when you said love and authenticity, I think that real love embraces authenticity. It is that higher frequency, because real love is authentic, if there's anything that's authentic. But I told my friend Kim that I was so anxious to talk with you because that you would say anything. You were not going to stop talking about what you know. And that was exciting. I was really looking forward to that. I think we have to do that to the degree that we feel comfortable. I think we have to do that because we have to know what the darkness is, because it's destroying our children. It's destroying our world, our land, our souls. We have to know that. And then we have to know much deeper and much better. And I'm working on it, you know, that these higher frequencies of light and love, it's very powerful. Yes. And I think there's so many millions now on. And I certainly knew that when I had that vision. One vision, I couldn't try to say that I had anything to do with it. It was gnosis in the extreme, is that light was here, and it was here for everybody and every single person. No matter what we've gone through, probably because of what we've gone through, we're better, like your experience. And certainly all of my failures and the deaths in my family. My mother was killed by a car. And then 1 year later, my son, and speaking of synchronicity, he died exactly on the day and the hour that she did a year earlier. Then 2 years later, my husband. But all of those experiences helped me to grow, helped me to know that there is something so much faster than I had been able. And so our competition is really with ourselves, you know, is letting go of that limited person to the degree that we can, and seeing becoming something larger, which we are. Because we are it.
On that note, Betty, I shall say, first of all, please stay on the Zoom just so I can thank you properly after I push the button off. Absolutely wonderful. We will put links. Have you got social media, Betty? Is that something you use?
Kim handles that, yes, with social media.
Any links you want below, we'll put below. We will definitely put a link to your two books. That just leaves me to say much love to you and your wonderful country folk. I was gonna say countrymen, but you can't say men these days, country persons. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Like I said, I've really, really been looking forward to this. Please come back on any time. In fact, I will send you an invite if that's okay, because I think we could do this chat live and maybe take...
Yes, we just began.
Yeah.
We just began.
We'll take questions from people out there, because there's people are suffering and it's unnecessary, friends. You know, maybe it's necessary, but you will get over it, I promise you, you know. And it starts with learning to love yourself. So that being said, to our friends out there, massive love to you as well. Please, if you could like and subscribe, if you could support the Patreon, friends, it's $1.99 a month. It just means that I can then pay an editor, because there's not an awful lot of money in this podcasting game, contrary to what you might think. And we'll see you soon.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.